So we've already delved into the first verse of chapter six. We're not going to necessarily stick to the historicist view in this chapter, but I just wanted to give you, those of you who weren't here when I went through this, Floyd gave me some insights into the first verse that made me rethink because he doesn't take the historicist view. But I do. And so applying what he showed me, I decided that this the white horse has always been the pure church of the apostolic period. But it really doesn't make sense that these are churches. It almost makes sense more that these are authority figures, the writers, because they're given the right to do things. To take peace from the earth, for example, the red horse. And so, as I looked at this, I compared the white horse with the white horse in 19, which is clearly Jesus, right, is the rider of that horse. And the implements and the weapons are not the same. The rider of the white horse has a sword coming out of his mouth, which indicates the word of God. It does not indicate a physical weapon. So, thinking of that, I think it starts out with the pure church, but very quickly, the writer, the authority figure of that church, is given a bow and a crown. Who would that represent? And I came up with Constantine. For that church. Now, I don't know if that works with the historical view, but it might not, because I think the in the historical view, the second horse is Diocletian. I'm sorry, Domitian. The persecutions of Domitian. But
It's a parallel view.
it's a parallel view. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there because I'm now revisiting this. I do not think that we have to think our views on Revelation are set in cement.
Definitely.
Well, wasn't there, I'm trying to remember now, I'm going to have to go back and rewatch Zygmunt Tonstad's Revelations series that he's got on YouTube. But I remember him pointing out a traditional historicist view and then a modern, updated historicist view, and then other ways to think about everything. And I kind of take the idea that if you have more views that you can understand and grapple with, there's probably more complete picture than holding tightly to one.
And that third seal, well, I don't want to jump into this in the middle. Why don't we start at the beginning? And we can just discuss it as though I never said anything.
Well, Floyd, I expect a lot of questions from you so that we take a long time and I can watch a video before next week.
I'm good at questions.
I can do the listening.
So what do you want to read?
Read, why don't we just do one little piece at a time? Verse one to verse two.
Do you want me to do that, or did you have
Sure.
some? Okay,
No.
I'll just volunteer.
I would pick on you, Jill.
Okay, Revelation 6, verse 1 and 2 from the Free Bible Version. I watched as the Lamb broke open the first of the seven seals. I heard one of the four living creatures shout with a thunderous voice, "Come!" I looked and saw a white horse. Its rider was holding a bow. He was given a crown, and he rode out conquering so that he would be victorious.
Mine says from victory to victory, which would sound like what I think it is, but
the Mayan says conquering and to conquer.
Mm-hmm. Well, victory mine says, is a synonym of conquering.
Yeah.
Now, are these the four horsemen of the apocalypse?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
This is where we get that.
Revelation is the apocalypse.
Yes. And these are the four horses and riders.
Mm-hmm. Is it okay to look at a paraphrase here and there?
Sure.
I got in verse 2. So I looked and I saw that the war began with a rider on a white horse, holding a bow and wearing a crown, symbolizing Lucifer beginning his war in heaven under the guise of righteousness, yet intent on inciting rebellion and war and achieving conquest. Very different.
Well, I have to say, it fills in some of, okay, I'll just say this. When I read this and I read the horses, and I've gone through a lot of different iterations in my head, I have to admit, not that this is saying from eternity past, but in the Christian era, I can accept it, or going eternity past, that the first rider is not necessarily good. I could see it as the adversary.
Yes.
Anyway, I tossed that out there. And I don't know exactly where that has come from, except that these are four horses of the apocalypse and they're not good. maybe that's how I've tied it together, but I just see it as an adversarial rider to contrasting Christ.
Mm-hmm. I find it more consistent as far as methods of interpretation to... Well, if you start with the assumption that the seals are problematic, which is all set up in the previous chapter, which is why they're being broken, then why would there be some of them good and some of them bad?
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me more consistent to say the reason they're being broken is because they're all bad. And whatever is released at each seal needs to be viewed through that context. Secondly, on this seal, I find it very helpful to do a very critical analysis of comparing this with the one in 19. And when I do that, a lot of things begin jumping out at me. And thirdly, I came to the conclusion that the reason the horse in 19 and the rider show up so late in the book is because it wasn't safe for us to hear words like he wages war until everything up to 19 makes it explicitly clear how the lamb fights so that it's not misunderstood. This is early on. And so everything I've seen, everything I see in Revelation and throughout scripture, for every original, there's a counterfeit. For every counterfeit, there's an original. That rule of thumb has unlocked all kinds of things for me. And so when I compare this with 19, all of a sudden it's like, oh, wait a minute, this sure looks like a counterfeit. There's just too many faults hidden in there. And it would be like Satan. Well, I mean, you know, he masquerades as an angel of light. Well, of course he's going to ride a white horse. How else is he going to deceive you? Everybody knows it's the good guy on the white horse.
I want to ask a follow-up. So there are different views, like the paraphrase we heard suggests that, and I'm not uncomfortable with saying the seven seals are popping the seals of the great controversy as opposed to the Christian era. I think I grew up thinking that this was the Christian era, and that's where I kind of...
That's traditional.
Yeah. Well, at least in our tradition.
Right, right.
And so are there allusions, suggestions within the text that expand or limit, or is it open?
When I read Tim's paraphrase of this, I actually found it very appealing. I had never thought about that before, of applying it to the entire spectrum of the great controversies of the war. And so I find that actually could hold water. Again, I don't think there is a single exclusive interpretation of this. I don't have a problem with saying, you know what, this one fits really good, and that one fits pretty good, and this one, well, it sort of fits. But, you know, having said that, I'm like, so which one might fit the best?
The only one that seems to allow for something that we think that we have seen in not our time, but in time before us, is where it ends. It ends with the second coming of Christ. And so it would seem to that there's still room for the historicist view. Oh, but yeah. how we get there, mm-hmm, is open to interpretation.
And which historicist view?
Yeah.
Because the one with Lucifer, that's history too.
Yeah.
Well, this is, so if we're talking Adventist traditional historicism, or are we talking a historicist view that's broader?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think we're talking a historicist view that is broader.
Okay. So now, and I don't know if there's a difference, but when I, and so I may need some correction on this. There's the book called The Great Controversy Between Christ and Satan, I think, mm-hmm, is the subtitle.
Yeah, that's the full time.
For me, that is the universal story.
Yes.
Before creation to third coming.
Yeah. And this could be the same.
That's what I was going to. So it is possible, mm-hmm, to see it a few different ways, but to me, that's the single, you know, I need a big picture. I need to see a big picture.
And I think that's what this book is for.
What is interesting is the second, and I'm jumping ahead here, but the second seal pictures the rider taking peace from the earth. Mm. That's the first mention of the earth. The first rider has nothing to do with the earth.
Just seeking to conquer.
Mm-hmm. Interesting, Gene.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought the same thing. If their goal is to conquer, that's not Jesus.
And if you want to say that this is, that you have the great controversy as it began in heaven and how it begins in stages on earth, you could also say that then you have a repeat of that great controversy in the early Christian church with the rise of Constantine, Augustine. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And this is where I find in all of these sets of sevens and everything throughout Revelation, I'm looking for the patterns, a sequence of patterns in it. You can, and that becomes a template. Now, if you take that template and you stretch it out over the entire great controversy, it just might line up. You take that template and shrink it down and line it up to the Christian view. And hey, you can find lining points. You could shrink it down even more, possibly. I don't know about this set of sevens, but some of them, I think this template is reusable. Mm-hmm. And it's applicable in various venues.
What? 1260 days might be figurative and literal?
Absolutely. In fact, Ellen White actually explicitly talks about that, and people don't like to read that.
Mm. What I thought was interesting with this, and I think it was the Revelation for Dummies I read several years ago, and they talked about that some view this as Jesus because he's on the white horse, but they also pointed out that he's in bad company, you know, so, and leading this entourage, and nothing is good in what follows, you know, this is the leader. And I really appreciate your point, Gene, because Satan's intent was to conquer the cosmos, not just the earth. Right. He intended to ascend above the throne of God, above the clouds. You know, he wanted everything. It was all out. And mm-hmm. I think it was interesting that this writer was holding a bow, which is a, you know, a weapon to mm-hmm. use. It's not the sword of truth coming out of Jesus's mouth. And he was given a crown. He didn't have a crown, as the Revelation 19 writer has a crown.
Yeah, that's
this
right.
one was given.
Yes,
you know, so it wasn't like, it,
yeah,
that's very essential. It wasn't like, I have this in and of myself. It was given to him in his creaturely status. And that wasn't
who would have given it to him?
Oh, God. I mean, God, anyway, God created him and he wasn't content with his creaturely status.
Right, but somebody
wanted to be God. Yeah.
Yes. And so in the second layer, which maybe represents the early Christian church, you see, that's exactly what happened with Constantine.
Yeah.
He was given a crown.
Mm.
And went out to conquer and to conquer. And he was told to conquer by this sign, the sign of the cross. So that's what intrigues me about this. Is just on the second layer, on the first layer, I think you're absolutely right. When it refers to the great controversy. And I think what you're seeing is in every age, just about, and we're just seeing the microcosm of it, in every age, we see a replication of the same thing as Lucifer falling from heaven.
Yes. And it makes sense to me just sequentially for God to help us try to see that larger view.
Exactly.
Sense in the lifetimes that we live and the kind of oppressive regimes and the tactics and principles that they follow. And it's evident that if you're, you know, using power, force, coercion, that is not of God. And we see Constantine using power, force, coercion, that is not of God in his, exactly. in his type of conquering.
Yeah.
So yeah. The white horse, is that a traditional symbol? Would that have been understood by John and his readers as something?
From Zechariah.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Is it important whether the horse is white or pale? What's the original?
There's a pale horse.
Because that seems to have a different connotation to me than a white horse.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A pale horse stands for death. So I looked and there was a pale green horse.
Mm-hmm.
Pale green?
Verse 8.
Yeah, well, that's really dead.
I haven't heard.
That's really, really dead.
That's my translation. That's the common English Bible.
That's green dead.
Green dead. He had, he was full of, what is it called? gangrene.
Yeah.
Because we have white, red, black, and pale green. And so it would seem, reading, that there's significance in the colors of the horses.
Yes, there is.
And
the first one is white. The first one is white. The last one's pale. Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Okay.
So you go from something that looks pure and holy, and you end up with death.
See, that's where I was thinking. You see almost this mm-hmm. natural progression that apostasy takes, if you will.
Yes. Yes.
Or rejection.
You can actually say that maybe the four forces of the apocalypse represent the great controversy. I mean, if you want to slice it that way.
Yeah.
And then what happens in the last seals, the three last seals. But it does happen on earth. So I think this is a war starting in heaven, coming to this earth. And on earth, this is how it replicates that war.
Yeah.
Here's another, well, there's a few more, but here's another thing to inject into this. In Zechariah, I went back and looked carefully because there's two places in Zechariah that talk about four horses of the four colors.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at that very critically because Revelation is getting its ammunition from the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
So you need to go back and say, what is that talking about? It doesn't always mean the exact same thing. Mm-mm. Sometimes it even flips it opposite. But, you know, I look at the context of the four horses in Zechariah, which show up twice. And I'm looking right now at Zechariah 1. And it's the context is, you know, I ask my Lord, what are these? The angel who talked with me said to me, I will show you what these are. The man who stood among the myrtle trees answered, they are the ones Yahweh has sent to go back and forth through the earth. They reported to the angel of Yahweh who stood among the myrtle trees and said, we have walked back and forth through the earth, and behold, all the earth is at rest and in peace. And I said, that sounds an awful lot like Job.
Mm-hmm.
And well, that, Satan. Yes.
Satan says, I have gone up and down upon the earth and gone to and fro upon it.
And everything's fine. Everybody's mm-hmm. fine with me. We got no problems down here. Everybody's doing exactly what I told them to do.
Well, yeah. So here's the question I end up with is that a genuine peace or is it a submission force
exactly.
peace?
Mm-hmm. And
they're doing what I told them to do, but I was going to beat them to crap right. if they didn't.
and that says, if I apply this back to Revelation, this white horse is conquered the world and hey, everything's under my control.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a counterfeit white horse. It's a counterfeit leader. And you know it's a counterfeit when you compare it very closely with the real white horse and the real leader.
Right.
In 19.
And it isn't a piece. It isn't a piece that passes understanding.
It's not as the world gives you, do I give to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly. It's a pacified piece.
That's what the note in the Free Bible said, that in this context, this piece has more to do with being forced into submission and defeat than a time of harmony and tranquility.
Yeah.
So it's Revelation compared to the imposed. It's a footnote.
Zechariah.
On Zechariah 1. It's a footnote in the Free Bible.
I see on Zechariah 1.
Yeah. Which they compare to the imposed Pax Romana of later times, where the Romans asserted their control, who they had defeated militarily, and their view of this is peace.
Yep.
Verse 11, Zechariah. Mm-hmm.
Another thing that I traced out, and I was just looking at my references, and I think I have 30 or 40 references to this one phrase, probably 20 of them just in Revelation. It was given to him.
Yep.
That shows up over and over and over and over and over throughout Revelation. And in most cases, if I'm not mistaken, it does not specify who gave it. It just says it was given, and we jump to conclusions about who gave it to him. It's like, no, wait, leave that open.
Well, can that, how in the Greek or Hebrew or Aramaic or whatever, what would that sort of mean? Because it's like, if I demand or command a something, and people acquiesce, is it given to me?
No. Look at Germany under Hitler.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody thought it was Hitler they needed to go after. The resistance tried to kill him multiple times, but killing Hitler wouldn't have changed anything. Hitler was who he was because the people wanted him. Mm-hmm. They gave him the crown. They gave him the throne.
Right.
They gave him everything.
That's right.
So it was given to him
by the ones
who pledge
he
allegiance.
Rules over. And that's actually how true authority operates.
Yes.
In English,
operates.
In English, that's the passive voice. Is that also true in the Greek?
Let me find out.
It doesn't say anything about it doing it or anybody else doing it. It's a passive. It just happened.
Right. And was given a crown. Okay, verse 2. It's passive. Edothe. he was given, it was given to him, a Stephanos, a crown.
Look up Revelation 13:7 and see if that's the same thing.
13:7?
Yes.
Yes. Kai odothe autu. I'm sorry, auto. Poesai. Polemo. Polemon. So it was given to him to do war upon the Lamb.
And
conquer him.
That goes over and over and over, is that given to him, and it doesn't explicitly say who gave it to him. It just says it was given to him.
And in verse 7, there's that one to attack, but there's also over every people, tribe, language, and nation. So it's given to him twice in verse 7 of 13.
Yeah.
Was it the same?
Yes,
it
would be, that's right.
It would be passive both times.
Okay.
I'm and sure. then, and then it was given to him to give life to the image of the beast. It shows up so often, and it's most often, you know, I should look at that. But all the times that I can recall off the top of my head, it's usually on the negative side that it's given to him.
Mm-hmm. Nothing is given to God.
Yeah. So in 19... there is no given to him. He has the crowns. Mm-hmm. He's wearing the crowns. They're not given to him.
So we can, based on that, Gene, nothing is ever given to God.
Other than praise.
Well, okay. But now,
I don't think that's in Revelation that's stated as given. They just, and they sang and they, you know.
Right. And I'm just saying in the, looking at the white horse, its rider was holding a bow. He was given a crown. This would exclude it being God or Christ.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've never thought it was Christ. I used to think in the historicist view that it was the early church, but I now think it's, you know, it's a composite of the early war in heaven as what happened in the early church.
Yeah.
Our evangelical friends, I'm sure, would say that not only does nobody gives anything to God, but also nobody gives anything but God. So that they would immediately say, well, if it was given to him, God had to do it. Is there anything in the text that would support or contradict that?
Well, it just was given. There's no God in the text. It's like all the times you have wrath in the New Testament and translators put in God's wrath. God isn't in the text necessarily.
Right.
So we could say that the interpreters and translators gave God that authority of wrath.
their view of God is that nothing happens unless God does it.
Mm-hmm. I tell
that's
you.
Man making God in his image, if you don't mind.
I tell you, I can hardly find a textbook that isn't either too liberal or isn't so Calvinist that I have to go through it and deconstruct with my students. This is not, but it really is. And it's over the sovereignty of God and the control of God, the predestination and all of that.
Yes. Floyd. Which really flies in the face of the freedom that God has given his creatures and everything ascribed to God, instead of saying, you know, well, people make choices and God honors that choice and he doesn't step in and overrule the choices that people make. He lets them be free, even though that those choices can be disastrous to the individual themselves and to others.
Mm-hmm. Another form of that given, Floyd, back to Job, who was given permission to do his dirty work with Job.
Yeah.
He had to get it. He had to be given the permission.
That's right. He had to be given the permission. In that case, you know, God gave him the permission, or at least that's what the text says.
Right. And then I look at this verse in 2, and I see that Satan needs to crown, because he's got to have the appearance He's got to give people the false impression that he is not who he is.
You can't be a counterfeit unless you got all the appearances.
Exactly. And he has been a deceiver from the beginning.
Yeah.
If he could deceive the most elect, if he could deceive a third of the angels, and Adam and Eve are much smarter than I, he's got it down. But seldom does he ever appear. Did he ever appear for who he was?
No.
Not in the garden, not with Job, not with the crown on his head on a white horse. I don't think he ever appears for who he is. He's a counterfeit.
Maybe at the cross.
Maybe in the hearts and lives of men.
I think yes, at the cross he was revealed to be a murderer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they watched him try to murder Jesus, and and he showed his real colors
to the universe, to the people,
but not to us.
So. I was looking at this bow. You know, what is the symbol of the bow? What do you flesh out of the bow?
There's two symbols, very distinct from each other.
Yeah.
A bow in Old Testament terms would remind us of Esau.
He took his bow out to hunt?
Well, I'm thinking archaeologically. The Edomites worshipped Kosh, which was the bow.
The shooting bow. The bow.
So they worshipped the hunting bow of Esau.
Okay.
So that's one use of the bow is you use it to go to war.
Ooh, you use it to hunt. Ooh, I got a comment on this. You're just triggering all kinds of stuff. You were saying that.
Well, can I finish?
Okay. Boy, put it in the comments.
The other one is the same word for a bow that you have arrows that fly from it is the same word for rainbow.
Oh, yes. That's what it's counterfeiting.
How about that? My true promise versus my counterfeit.
The bow is over the throne. But this rider is carrying a bow. It's not over the throne. He's carrying it as a hunting bow.
And he's been given it, whereas God's bow is who he is, represents who he is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah.
Wow, interesting. That's cool.
Okay, so the Edomites.
A bow would be a... Go ahead.
The Edomites.
Edomites.
Did you say they worshiped the bow?
They worshiped the bow, Kosh.
Okay. What?
That was their god.
That just, how can I got to get this out? So I assume that is in reference to Isaac telling Esau to go out and fix him venison so he can bless him. Isn't that the context for that?
Yeah, because he would use a bow. The problem is that the story doesn't ever mention a bow.
Okay. So if he goes out to get game to make his father's favorite venison, then this could really link back into I have to do something to earn my father's blessing. Which is a representative of the whole work system.
Yeah.
Well, that would be true for both of them because.
Well, I know.
Because
It was Isaac's idea to get them to earn it. But
well, and Rebecca's idea was to get Jacob to earn it.
Yes.
And to produce a counterfeit because they used not wild game, but. Domesticated animals.
Right.
And she tried to make it taste like wild game.
So that's a fake on top of a fake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
The first fake meat.
Now, I'm.
I think it was real meat, but.
But it had to be doctored up to make it taste like the other meat.
Yeah, it did. But it just makes sense with the whole counterfeit deception, you know. Anyway, interesting.
In the story of Elisha and whatever king, as Elisha was about to die, the king came to see him, and Elisha said along the lines, take your bow and arrows and shoot, okay, one, and that's, you know, whatever victory. Now tap the arrows. Okay, so there's that story. Now here in Revelation, we have a rider on a white horse holding a bow, receiving a crown, and riding out to conquer. Is the assumption there's arrows, no arrows, does it matter?
Does it?
What good is a bow if you don't have arrows?
Well, if it's a counterfeit of the rainbow, you don't need arrows unless you have rain as arrows.
Well, he's riding out to conquer. But, oh, go ahead.
What if you tie that into the fiery darts of the wicked one?
Right.
Those fiery darts, in my understanding in that day, were flaming arrows, which would have been shot from bows.
Mm-hmm.
That you need the shield of faith to quench.
Mm-hmm. And which the Roman legions another hint would that, actually...
Where the source of this is.
Yeah. It's interesting. The Roman legions would... they had some kind of leather covering, and before they went to battle, they would drench that in water. So when the flaming arrows would hit, they would just sizzle and go out.
There's a kind of a tangential comment here on the bow. I mean, in I guess it's Greek, Apollo Farstriker was the bowman. And a bow is a very impersonal weapon. The sword, you got to get up there right in their face and hack them to death.
Mm-hmm.
A bow, you can stand a long ways off and it's very impersonal. You have no idea who the person is you're hitting. I don't know if that has any bearing here, but it just popped into my head that, well, the bow's a very impersonal weapon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well,
and a sword coming out of your mouth is really close.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, I don't know how much symbology is here, but as we brought up, there's no arrows mentioned. Maybe the bow is intended to appear to be a righteous bow.
A rainbow, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You wouldn't take arrows if you're trying to impersonate Christ, you know.
Well, that's sort of what I was kind of wondering, if the lack of arrows is an additional impersonation of peace, but the reality is conquer.
Right. Mm-hmm. The goal.
Yeah.
Yeah. How would you go out to conquer with a bow if you don't have any arrows? Right.
Well, and that's sort of, I mean, because the next horse is the red one, right? And, and its rider is given a large sword, and that goes to Mark's point, which is, this is what actually takes peace away. And it's up close and personal and, you know, Cain and Abel and on down. So I can see in the first stage of rebellion where you're imitating the Prince of Peace, your mindset is rebellion and conquering because you can't, right. You don't have it. You have to imagine it. So you go out
inside
as if you're light and you're peaceful. But then no one, I mean, even if a crown is given to you, it's given to you only by those pledging allegiance to you. And so you have to do more in order to get more. And that's where I see sort of this progression through the horses. Anyway, I was just kind of curious. I can do with or without the arrows and the assumption of that, but I was just kind of curious.
Well, to follow on that thread that you started, Bill, I think is important because there is a progression. And I think the progression maybe doesn't just go through the four horses, although I do think that's sort of a summary of the whole thing. But it's the entire seven seals. I think that the lamb, you know, which seal does he pick first? Does it make a difference? I think it does make a difference. I think he picks the seal that if these are all counterfeits, he picks the one that is the most difficult to unmask, and he goes after that one first. By the time you get to the fourth one, there's no hint of deception here. This is just all out death. But the first one is so convincing that a whole lot of Christians actually believe the counterfeit.
Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
Good point. And I thought this was interesting. If it's deception Lucifer's after here, what was he doing in heaven? He was inciting war and rebellion. He wasn't beginning a war. He was inciting it, just as Bill was saying, the progression. He was planting the seeds for the war and the rebellion to begin, but there was no war other than the talk,
in his own
the
mind.
Gossip. The gossip that began to
character assassination.
Sow character and doubts of God's goodness.
One other thing that stood out in being given a crown, riding out to conquer so that he would be victorious. Or when Jesus rides out is so we can be victorious. You know, he took the hit so we could overcome. And this character is just interested on his personal victory, his personal amassment of, you know, I conquered this and this and this. It's all about him.
Mm-hmm. So going back to what Bill was outlining,
I don't think it was original.
I like that. If you take the progression of that Lucifer took as the model or the template, and you apply it, this is the fall of the Christian church. The first four is the fall of the Christian church.
Wow.
They went the exact same way as Lucifer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They wanted power, they got it. They wanted to get people to do things exactly the way they wanted.
Or else,
and they removed peace.
That's
but
violence.
They got what they wanted. And so on.
Well, that follows Ezekiel 28, because the sequence there is the multitude of your trading, that's the control. Violence was found within you. That's the red horse. And you sinned, which ends in death. There is a sequence there.
Mm-hmm. You became filled with violence and you sinned.
Mm-hmm.
It's at the point that violence erupts that you then know that the person has been unmasked.
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The violence starts inside and then it comes outside.
Mm-hmm. Because okay. Jesus described in Matthew 5, you know, that hate, murder, that it all comes from inside.
Yeah.
That's the origin.
In the black horse third seal, we have a scale. Now, we're ahead, but every time I read that, I have a knee-jerk reaction that goes to the scales of justice, which I abhor.
Yep.
But then it mentions more like inflationary pressures and economy.
It is. My version has the writer held a balance for weighing in his hands. And I heard what sounded like a voice from among the four living creatures. It said, a quart of wheat for a denarian and three quarts of barley for a denarian, but don't damage the olive oil and the wine. I have that same knee-jerk reaction, Bill.
Well, and so this is, are we saying the allusion to the scales of justice, which I think is satanic in its thing anyway, and how we do justice, right? And a scale that says merit or whatever. So, but then it sounds like not only might that have some semblance of civility, it's now gotten out of whack and justice is perverted. Human justice, even that, becomes super perverted with inflationary pressures of whatever. But then I also see the idea of part of that progression could be the damage that we do to each other throws the economy out of whack. But then Jesus or God gave us a whole different economy, which was never really observed in the Jewish culture. Anyway, TMI.
You know, I have found this a perplexing horse and rider. Because it feels like a mixture of things. And I haven't been able to find something that made sense. And I'm always looking for coherence, which is one of my downfalls, I think. The black horse would represent violence, it seems to me. And once you start weighing out in an economic system, and they use these balances way back in antiquity in the Hebrew economy, where they've had maybe a rock that they would put on one side and you had to put X amount of wheat on the other. But sometimes they would
switch the rock out.
they would do something to make it heavier, no, weight lighter on that other side so that you would get less for the same amount of money.
Mm-hmm.
And the prophets talk about that, the injustice of the balances.
Just weights and scales.
Just weights and scales, yeah. But later in Christianity, those balances became used on people.
Mm-hmm.
Not literally.
Moral.
But figuratively. And the whole view of judiciary righteousness, judiciary atonement, judiciary reasoning began to overplay in theology.
Variable value.
And so if this was a voice from among the four living creatures, so this is a heavenly voice. It says, a quart of wheat for a denarian, 3 quarts of barley for a denarian, but don't damage the olive oil and the wine. What does that mean?
Almost seems like a non sequitur. It's like, what is one, talking about price, and then they're talking about damaging something else. I don't understand.
I know, this is why I've struggled with this passage, is because of the coherence.
But we're three horses ahead already.
Well, right. So,
are you saying hold your horses?
Hold back your horses.
Do we know if this price that they're talking about is a very
A day's wage?
It was
a day's wage. Yeah, denarian.
It was highly inflationary.
And my understanding of that would be barely enough to sustain life. You could get by, but barely. Wheat, that amount of wheat and barley would just...
Don't touch, and maybe damage is a poor word. What are your other versions have for verse 6? Don't damage the wine or the olive oil or the wine.
Mine says damage.
Yours says damage.
New King James says don't harm. Very similar.
Don't hurt.
Don't hurt.
It Strong says to be unjust. To do morally, socially, or physically hurt. To injure. To be an offender. To be unjust.
To harm would be to make the price formidable.
Yeah.
So that the people would be able to use those products, olive oil and wine. So this voice is doing damage control.
Yeah, right.
Boundary setting.
Yes.
Yeah.
And by doing that, he allows survival. So these are almost like plagues that we're looking at.
And it, okay. And the plagues are not God sent. These are consequences of the adversarial damage. Okay.
Exactly.
I think the economic system that Lucifer invented, the whole idea of trading, period, was invented by Lucifer.
Yeah.
And initially it looked absolutely innocuous, nothing wrong with this, innocent. And in Ezekiel, it says, your excessive trading. So it's like, it's not that trading with somebody is a sin, but he turns it into an obsession. And as soon as you create trading, you immediately introduce the concept of debits and credits, which then opens the door for offenses. Because if you don't get what you expected in return, you now begin taking offense. And the more offenses you accumulate internally, now you start feeling violated because you're not getting what you paid for. All of that was foreign to heaven.
Right.
Because where everybody had always received freely and given freely, and it was like no expectation of return. And suddenly this whole new concept, which was exciting at first, but then it starts devolving into these new strange feelings that are foreign. And that's where it all started, I think.
And you can take that down to earth.
Mm-hmm.
Where Lucifer really did that.
Yes.
Was in ancient Mesopotamia. Yeah. That's where it began. And I actually have an incredible book by a very prominent Assyriologist who has mapped out the whole history of the economic system and how it began. And I don't know, it's a pretty steep book to read. But if any of you are interested, I can give you the name of the book. He has another one that looks easier to read.
I would be interested in that, yeah.
You would? Okay, let me grab my... Oh, it's right beside me. I'm looking for my phone. It's in Kindle, so I have to look it up. Bill, would you be my typist? Put that in chat, please.
Sure. Yeah.
I have amazing books that, you know, I could... God planned for me to study the ancient Near East at just the right time. When I started in 1987, the only books you had were books of texts, and those were limited because there are many more texts than there were books. And history books and books on religion, general books that only touch the surface. By the time I finished my doctorate, there were a slew of books coming out that were much more informative, dealt with more individual topics and more detail.
The Ancient Near East History, Society, and Economy?
Yep, that's it. By Liv Rani?
Yep. I'll put the link to Amazon.
Oh, good.
We have discussed that one before because I had it saved.
Oh, you did? Yeah.
I remembered that one.
So Mark, in the chat is a link to Amazon and the book.
But the one I have now is called Assyria.
By the same author?
Yes. I have been using extra self-control not to get into it because I'm not ready for it yet. Books are to me like water is to a thirsty person. I want to read you this book, Assyria, the Imperial Mission. And in ancient traditions, Assyria was the first world empire in a series that continued with Persia, Macedonia, and Rome. Often overlooked by modern studies of empire, Assyria provides an example of the simple form of empire and imperialism. before subsequent developments resulted in structures of greater complexity. Most important among the basic features of empire is the imperial mission, the mandate given by the gods or God to the emperor to extend through conquest or persuasion, annexation or hegemony, the power of the central state to the entire world. Assyria, by bringing the most populated civilized countries of its time into submission, came close to fulfilling its mission. And so here are the chapters. Imperialism, materiality, and ideology. That would be your economics. God's will. Communicating with God. Holy war and just war. Exploring and conquering. Disposable periphery. Collecting, public display, marketing territory. Marking territory, I'm sorry, the steles, celebrative inscriptions, royal titulature, the justification of self-defense, battles and sieges, oaths and their transgression, punishment and forgiveness, destruction and reconstruction, exporting despotism, organizing the territory, the city at the center of the world, organizing the territory, provinces and governors, from tributaries to deportees, the communication network. Becoming Assyrian, imperial prosperity, cultural unification, technology, religion, language. Conclusions, the prototype empire. Conclusions, trajectories of imperialism. Conclusions, celebration and reality. The view of others, ancient and modern empires.
Wow.
To now. It's going to be an incredible read.
The first seal.
Back to not economics. Huh?
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
The balance and the bow. And not the bow, but the balance. Isn't it interesting that you have a construction of a bow and a balance that almost configure to the converse?
Yep, they look very similar.
Somewhat similar.
In fact, on the top of a balance scale would be the bow, or the crossbar is right. Often bow shaped.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
I'd like to take this from the beginning because, like Floyd said, in heaven, as in the Garden of Eden, there was only grace.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have economics. And once you have economics, and I'm taking a quick leap over mm-hmm. what Floyd said, when you have economics, you start valuing yourself accordingly.
Mm.
Variable
what
value
did is devalue mm-hmm. human beings,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. which then goes into hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can I take us to and tell me if this is like
no? Go ahead. I'm pausing for.
Okay, so the Leviticus and I think Deuteronomy, but certainly Leviticus, we have. Temple services.
Mm-hmm.
And then in Deuteronomy, I think we have the economic system of debt, erasure, jubilee, all these mm-hmm. cycles.
Actually, jubilee is in Leviticus, I think.
Oh, is it still? Okay. Okay. But the idea to me is here, let's say Leviticus, and we're trying to counter the Babylonian-esque or Assyrian influence. Genesis is a counter narrative, and we just go on down to, in essence, at least I didn't grow up with the sanctuary this way, but I'm wondering, is it really about restoring, in essence, it's the garden, it's coming into contact with God, it's reestablishing our value and worth and not having it be economic? Because when Jesus comes along and he's overthrowing the tables, it has taken on a different meaning again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I like that because actually.
He also freed the birds and the animals in the temple.
What I like about that is that in the sanctuary service, the sinner is the one that kills the animal.
Mm-hmm.
There's no economics in that. there's responsibility by pressing the head on the animal. And then by killing the animal, the sinner signifies my sin led to this animal's death. And there's to be a direct connection between sin and death, which is why I often quote patriarchs and prophets, that this was to show that it is sin that leads to death, as it is in the case of Jesus. Jesus' death shows that sin leads to death. And what is restored is, like you said, our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it falls short. Jesus transforms that whole image in the parable of the prodigal son.
Mm-hmm.
He takes the sacrifice and makes it a banquet,
mm-hmm,
with the fatted calf. And he takes the whole kind of downtone, kind of dolorous, depressing ambience of the whole situation. He takes that and turns it into a triumphal banquet and, mm-hmm, celebration.
And he talks about, well, even in that series, because that's the third of a series, right?
Right.
The previous two, you know, they're calling in their neighbors to celebrate with me. And I don't know if it's the same place where he says the angels in heaven rejoice every time a sinner, you know, comes back. Mm-hmm. And so, it's like this rejoicing, constantly rejoicing everywhere. And we're going, too much dancing.
And so if you keep going on the parable of the prodigal son, it's really not the prodigal son as much as the prodigal father.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Use the word prodigal to mean generous,
yeah,
almost lavish.
Mm-hmm.
Reckless.
Reckless, yes. From a traditional Jewish standpoint, he certainly did portray him as reckless. Mm-hmm. So you come to the end and the older brother, he was very angry.
Mm-hmm.
He says, you never once gave me so much. Here, I've slaved for you all these years, and you never once gave me so much as a kid to celebrate with my friends. And this wanton rascal comes back. You give him fatted calf, and you throw a party. Father says, my son, all that I have is yours. So you have to go back to the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When the father...
Seems like that.
When the younger son leaves home, the father divides to them,
mm-hmm,
his living. That means everything.
And the older son got two-thirds.
And he got the land because the son couldn't take off with that.
Mm-hmm.
So he naturally got the land, the livestock, everything.
It seems like the real point of the story is, well, first the father, but the point of the story is not about the younger son. It's the point of the story is about the older son.
Yeah, that's true. So what the older son, God, or the father is saying to him, you have always been with me,
mm-hmm,
and all that I have is yours. But when your brother came home, I had to celebrate. And so I did take the fatted calf.
I'm sorry. It belonged to you.
All I have is the ring on my finger that I own.
And I gave that to my son.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So I'm going to bring this back now to the third, or whichever seal that is, third seal, and say, looking at the prodigal son, the reality, God's reality, is generosity and no scales,
mm-hmm,
no inflation,
mm-hmm,
and that rebellion against God's order of life, of living, which is in love and giving, produces this, and we've mentioned it, but I love where the conversation has gone, and it gives me a whole nother way of looking at what we've done in how we live to pervert regularly the scales of justice, the scales of economy, the value of another human being.
It's that whole picture is so damaged. Talk about damaging the oil and the wine. I probably shouldn't do this. I probably should do a spoiler alert, but
we'll rehash it when we get there.
Why is it that when the mark of the beast takes place, and that those who refuse to worship the beast and its image, are deprived of legal and economic support?
Because that's the system of the enemy. And if you won't play by our game and our rules, then you can't play the game.
Right. See. But it has a positive element for the
that's right
people who suffer, because they're finally deprived of all that stuff.
Right.
And they realize that a relationship with God is far more important.
Yeah.
And relationships with one another is far more important than having economic security and legal security.
Because everything in that system is our source of false identity.
Right.
How much we have to be cut off from every idol, which is our false sources of identity and worth, and put our complete trust, our complete dependence on what God thinks about us as static. And we cannot change God's thinking about us, that he loves us. We are infinitely valuable, and we can't do anything to increase that or decrease it. It's static.
And maybe that's what the verse means for about not damaging the oil, which some people see as the Holy Spirit, God's indwelling, and, you know, the wine, which can represent Jesus's blood and his sense of, I am in you, with you, for you. That obviously that, you know, speaks to what you were just saying. That matters more than anything else. Having that sense of value and worth based on God's view of me, not what I produce economically or attain from the worldly perspective.
And another view of his blood is, this is what you are worth.
Yes.
I would
yes.
give everything.
And oil also represents joy.
So maybe we could understand this as, these things are for sale, but these things are not.
You can't. Yeah, you can. You can go ahead and have the barley and the wheat, but you can't take these things.
Because and that's the authentic source.
In fact, I think back to the money changers when Jesus overturned. Wasn't his message, you can't buy your way in?
Yeah.
You're already accepted. You just receive it. It's already paid for. You don't buy it. I've paid for it. I'm willing to do all the, you just choose it, or you receive or you reject.
Somebody pointed out recently, I found this really helpful. When John the Baptist came, he scandalized the leadership by saying, you can come and be baptized for the forgiveness of your sins. What do you mean? You got to go to the temple. You got to do sacrifice. No, no mention of the temple. Well, that threatens the entire economy of their whole system. I mean, no wonder the Pharisees and everybody are upset, because he's undercutting their income. But
there's
Jesus comes along.
To that.
Jesus comes along, and he doesn't even tell them to get baptized. He just says, oh, your sins are forgiven you. End. What do you mean? You can't do that.
You're not going to worship here to the woman at the well, or in Jerusalem, but in spirit and in truth.
You're
which kind
destroying
of takes away
our
the
entire economic and religious order and our authority. You are destroying everything we depend on for our identity. You've got to go.
Who gave you the authority? We didn't. And we're the authority.
That's right.
In verse 6, I mean, as we're talking about this, because this is, I heard what seemed to be a voice coming from among the four living creatures, which are in very God's very presence, that said, and then it goes into the wheat and barley and don't damage the oil or the wine. So what's the significance of that voice coming from the very center of the throne room and from the creatures closest to God himself, right? Aren't the four living creatures closer to God than any other descriptor of what heaven looks like in the previous two chapters?
Can I put an addendum question on that?
Sure.
I was wanting to get back to the first one, because on each of these four horses, it says one of the four creatures said,
yes, come.
So my curiosity started rising, and I said, which one of the four creatures? What if it's one of the four creatures for each one of the horses?
Yeah.
That's what Jennings says. Come and see each time.
Yeah, come and see. So well, there's a pattern here. There's four there. There's four there. Why would the same one always say, announce all four of them? No, you're probably pairing up four and four.
Yeah.
And they probably have something to do with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So then I started saying, okay, well, what attributes here might match attributes over there? I don't know if it's even important or not, but, you know, I have to ask questions.
So I want to come back to John the Baptist baptizing people. He also scandalized them that he would even think they needed to be baptized.
Oh, yeah.
Because the tradition of the Jews was that they were baptized in the loins of their forefathers who went through the Red Sea.
Mm-hmm.
So you're denying your very heritage.
Yeah.
Right, because they baptized Gentiles.
Yeah.
But right. John the Baptist was the first baptizing Jews, right? Yeah. There wasn't a history of previous baptizers.
Scandalous, to understate it.
He's a competitor financially.
So anybody want to say more about, we didn't really deal with the second seal. I think it's pretty self-explanatory in a way, but more. Anything to add to that?
Well, that was, oh, go ahead.
I just think it's interesting that you have this white horse, you know, with the bow, the crown, and then what happens immediately after this is peace is severed. You know, people are butchering each other. It's a very gruesome, very quick reality that occurs after the first rider goes out.
Yeah.
Butchering, slaughtering. It's not a pretty visual.
Again, this rider was given a large sword.
Where did Cain get his whatever he had?
Weapon?
Yeah.
He could have had something similar to a shovel or something. I don't know.
Well, I mean, this is where I look and I say, that's obviously the jealousy, the insecurity, the misplaced identity is leading him to resent his brother. And I see this second seal being the revelation of that death and all that followed from it. I mean, it could be more.
That's true. It was the first murder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the Christian era, where would we say Constantine or Augustine or whichever one took power? He looked virtuous. And then, you know, how would we do that in the Christian era?
That's a good question. I'm wondering if this refers to the Crusades. The Crusades were done when Augustine could have been, but I see him as more as number one.
Yeah.
Because
he had to mature.
But he was the first to say that when dealing with heretics, you had the right to slaughter.
Mm-hmm.
Going further, you're dealing with Anselm. with the Crusades, at least the second, starting the Second Crusade. While the Second Crusade was being planned by Leo II, Pope Leo II, Anselm was writing Cur Deus Homo. Cur Deus Homo. When Which God is, became man. And it's his treatment on the atonement. And I believe that historically, the belief on the atonement led to violence and bloodshed. A false belief.
You have God.
That was all emerging at the same time with Crusades.
Yeah, he was right. He was actually, his Pope Leo and he were friends. And while the writer is John Carroll, Constantine, let's see.
Constantine sword, the Sword of Constantine.
Swords, oh. Constantine's Sword.
Yeah.
Yeah. He depicts Anselm writing that treatment, that treatise, while Pope Leo II, his friend, is plotting out how he's going to do the Second Crusade.
So two questions. Do we know the number of deaths related to the Crusades? Has anybody estimated that?
Millions.
I'm sure somebody's estimated it, but I'm sure thousands.
And think about the seeds of, the seeds sown.
The cycles of vengeance put into place.
Mm-hmm. Correct. Mm-hmm.
And revenge.
Mm-hmm. And wasn't there also an economic incentive because they would bring back, quotes, holy things from the Holy Land, and that was used by the Catholic Church or used by the church in power to increase their economic income because people mm-hmm. would do pilgrimages and pay to see. And wasn't that connected to?
And furthermore, they wanted to convert these people. The Crusades were not just to wantonly kill. They were to hold the sword to the throat and say, you become a Christian.
It also got the powerful monarchs and their armies out of the way. Gave them something to do other than
fight each other.
Threaten the Pope's, most specifically threaten the Pope's
authority.
Temporal power. Mm. Yeah.
Interesting, Gene, you bring up the sword. You put the sword to someone's throat and say, become a Christian or else. That's not God's ways. And so if Satan is the rider of the first horse, why wouldn't he be the rider of the second horse? Mm-hmm. And if a sword represents, truth coming out of Jesus' mouth and does damage to people, what is the damage? Well, the truth hurts people that are rejecting it. So what is Satan's language with his large sword if it isn't lies about God that severs the bonds of love and trust?
It's actually the counter of God's sword, of Jesus' sword coming out of his mouth, because that's the word of God. It's the counter to the word of God. I will use force.
Mm-hmm. That's what I mean. Yeah, he's using lies, force, whatever. Power, coercion, and it leads to selfishness and rebellion and killing.
Yeah.
Seems to me.
There's a counterpart to this taking peace from the earth, Zechariah 9:10. And then Jesus has a curious comment in Matthew 10:34.
He will cut off the chariot from Ephraim and the war horse from Jerusalem. The bow used in battle will be cut off. He will speak peace to the nations. His rule will stretch from sea to sea and from the river. So when you get rid of all his weapons, mm-hmm. you have peace.
So it's the very opposite of that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then what was Jesus?
Matthew 10:34.
Don't think I've come to bring peace to the earth. I haven't come to bring peace, but a sword. I've come to turn a man against his father and a daughter against her mother. And a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, people's enemies, the members of their own house. How does Jesus do that?
Truth.
He brings truth.
Yeah. Truth
right. Yeah, truth always divides.
So the peace that he is neutralizing is the peace of co-opted deception.
Mm-hmm.
When you begin embracing truth and the people around you resist it, you suddenly bring division
mm-hmm.
and loss of peace,
and you get
which is an incentive why a lot of people won't believe the truth, because they don't want to lose the peace.
Exactly. They don't want to suffer too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kind of related. Somebody noted that the deception might not be so much pulling the wool over somebody's eyes, but simply telling them what they already believe and want to believe. So Satan doesn't have to do much of anything at all to deceive.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true sometimes, but I think there are other times when it's blatant, intentional misinformation.
Well, I would think he would use the strategy he used with Eve in the garden. He first gave her what she wanted. He acted like he was saying what she was thinking.
Mm.
And got her to respond by exaggerating it. He got her to respond. And that hooked her in. And she responded under his influence. It was like he cast a spell on her. And she responded by making the thing seem more legal and more less like God. He said, you should not eat of this tree, neither shall you touch it, lest you die. Neither shall you touch it. It was not in God's original words. And what God said is, you will surely die, not threat, you will die. So she does that. And then when he realizes he has her, he says, you will not surely die. And that's his blatant deception. But he has her.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't really lie until he knows she's ready to believe it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, wasn't that how the war in heaven began? Just a little gossip here and there until people began to wonder, well, maybe there's some truth to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, we have, shall we continue to the fourth horse? So when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature say, come. So I looked, and there was a pale green horse. Its rider's name was Death, and the grave was following right behind. They were given authority over the fourth of the earth to kill by sword, famine, disease, and the wild animals of the earth. So how is this? This seems a little bit like the second horse. Is there a mirror perception, and does one come out of the other?
Well, when you study the impact of war on civilizations, you are right. There is this consequence of, scarcity, famines, supply chains impacted. People don't get enough to eat. They're more susceptible to disease. I don't know about the wild beast, but you can't normally, there's that. Those consequences that come with war that are very impactful, that, illness and disease, not enough food often kills as many people as the war itself does, or sometimes more brief historical overview of conflicts on the earth.
In ancient Israel and other lands, ancient Near East, if you decimated a city, the wild animals took over immediately.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Makes sense.
And so, yeah, so there's that definite extension, sequential events.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking about the one with the, the scales can also be used for rationing.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't need scales if there's plenty of everything.
Mm-hmm.
But when there's barely enough to survive, suddenly the scales come out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a form of tightening controls.
So you're saying that this is already a thing in the first, in the third seal. Now we're in the fourth, and this is just the ultimate conclusion.
It's a progression.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I see it as additive.
What do you guys make about authority over a quarter of the earth? Again, a boundaries, a limiting by, you know, someone who was giving them authority. What do you make of that?
It could mean, going back to Job, that Satan requests a third of the earth. He may have requested the whole earth, and God said, no, you can't have the whole earth. Well, may I have two-thirds of the earth? No, you can't have two-thirds of the earth. Well, may I have a third of the earth? Something along those lines. Mm-hmm. It could also be that the third of the earth has become so corrupted that they have banished God from their lives. Mm-hmm. And this is the natural consequence. But there would still be something going on in the court of heaven with Satan claiming that right. So I still think Satan's in the picture somewhere here.
When I see this, I think not so much even a boundary of, like, you can have Africa, but you can't have any of the rest of the continents or something like that. You can have North America, but you can't have everything else. I see it as a global consequence of the prior three things, but limits in its damage overall. It's mm-hmm. not going to destroy everyone or half, but it is going to, and it's not that it's a literal quarter, but that it's significant.
Mm-hmm. It's not arbitrary. That's important too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason that it was that portion.
I like Sigvi's approach on some of these. He and I completely agree with his assessment of this, particularly about the one third. Every time, and I've tested this and it works very well. Every time in Revelation that you see the one third, it's like a brand name. Because numbers are not, well, everything in Revelation is symbolic, even mm-hmm. the numbers. Mm-hmm. So you say, what is the symbol this number is telling me? Mm-hmm. Well, one third, we should know what that symbol means.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's a brand of the one who got a third of the angels out of heaven.
Mm-hmm.
So every time you see one third, it's, you know who's behind this. Mm-hmm. It's him up to something here.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I've noticed that as I go through Revelation, starting here, you've got a quarter.
Mm-hmm.
Then pretty soon you start running to thirds. Then you start running to half, if I'm not mistaken. And then it's everything.
The whole world wonders after the beast.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and total destruction and total everything. And it progresses. Well, I mean, if you go from fourth to third to half to whole, you there's an obvious progression of evil taking over. And I think that message is not so much it's an actual quarter, but it's saying, okay, here it's starting here. It's going to keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger until it takes over.
I appreciate that, Floyd, because mm-hmm. it's this growing progression. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger until God intervenes. And I appreciate you sharing
it's
that.
It's interesting, isn't it, that I'm going to change the topic a little bit, but it's not totally changed. That when you start out in Revelation 4, it says, you are worthy, our Lord mm-hmm. and God, to receive glory and honor and power because you created all things, and by your will it is by your will that they existed and were created. And then in chapter 5, blessing, honor, glory, and power belong to the one seated on the throne, to the Lamb forever and always. You are worthy to take the scroll and open its seals because you were slain and by your blood you purchased for God at persons from every tribe, language, people, and nation. You made them a kingdom of priests and priests to our God, and they will rule on the earth. Worthy is the slaughtered lamb to receive power, wealth, wisdom, and might, and honor, and glory, and blessing. And I've heard every creature in heaven, and I already read that. In chapter 6, verse 8 is a long verse. They were given authority. There's nothing in Revelation 4 or 5 that gives God authority over.
That's right.
So I'm going to look at 19 because I haven't asked this question before. No, there's nothing that says about that God has given authority.
That's right. And I think we should be very cautious to assume anywhere that when it says authority was given, that it's coming from God.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. Another translation, NIV, says they were given power over. Mm-hmm. And that sounds much more like.
Yeah, but if it says authority in other translations, the word is excusio, which is authority. Okay. It's not power. It's only power in a secondary way, as in the power that you have by authority. Dunamis would be the word if it were power. Yeah, I see this authority would be that part of the earth that had given Satan certain jurisdiction by their rejection of God and his love.
Right. And I think it's a progressive given over to Satan, a progressive given over to evil. That's why the numbers keep getting bigger as you go through Revelation, is that a higher and higher percentage of those who dwell on the earth, which is a key phrase all through Revelation, a higher and higher percentage is completely under Satan's control, until finally you have the final showdowns starting at 16.
Mm-hmm. So, with the last plagues.
If we take, I'm just trying to place context again with the idea that there's a great controversy, universal view, and we see this progression coming. We can see cycles of the third, the black horse. We can see that with aspects of the fourth horse and cycles of that throughout Earth's history. Now, in the Christian era, if I take this, we tend to place it down somewhere. The medieval time, you know, we said something about second horse was maybe like the Crusades. Then there's the third and the fourth. Where would these fall in interpretation, typically in a historicist view?
I don't remember the exact where the boundaries are for each period. I do believe, if we're jumping to the fifth seal, the souls under the altar represent the persecution during the Reformation. The Inquisition, I should say. Inquisition.
So the other two would happen before that. That's the idea. Okay.
I find
Inquisition doesn't come that far behind the Crusades.
I grew up with the traditional view. That's what I was taught my whole life. I never questioned it till recently. But I always had questions in my head because the dissonance created on some of the assumptions and the assertions and even the dogmatic ways in which it was presented. And I'd think, well, that seems like it's really twisting the facts to force fit it to fit this prophecy kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then one of my questions, which I've never been able to even force fit, is, okay, so the church, the Christian church, was hijacked by Constantine and then the popes. And at what point in your interpreting the sequence of these prophecies, which church? Because the souls under the altar are not the same one as the one who put them there. But all the way up to that, we're saying that the church was, or implying that the church was the one taken over by the Pope, but then suddenly it's not. And there's no explanation for how did you jump from that ban over to this one?
I think, Floyd, that this is the result of not applying the war in heaven to the whole chapter 7 or 4 to 21 through or 22. Because if you had that canopy over it, the reason it jumps to the souls under the altar is because that's how far the church had fallen, that it would have souls under the altar. That's how I would interpret that.
That the church itself had embraced Satan's lies about God, basically.
It had. It had completely embraced that. So there was, however, Daniel refers to the revelation, Reformation period as a, or the Reformation as a little help.
Yeah, I read that this morning.
What?
A little help. The Reformation is a little help.
Yeah.
And if you think of Ellen White pointing out that the Reformers did not give up all their errors,
but it splintered the power.
Yeah. Yeah, it did do that. But the Seventh-day Adventist Church did not come out of the Reformation. It came out of the Radical Reformation.
Is that the Anabaptists and Mennonites?
The Anabaptists and Mennonites, yeah.
But I think we've sort of laid that back in the dust.
I wasn't going to say anything.
we jumped over to the normal Reformation and because so we could be accepted.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I see that, yeah, coming in the 50s, but I think the ground was laid around 1900 to go that direction.
Mm-hmm.
As I've read it, but I don't have good grasp of Adventist history, so it's just sort of my interpretation of what I've read. But this is the thing, that even in all of that, there are people in every tradition who seem still true to the essence of God.
Yes. Well, there's even people, I would take that, I think, a little farther to say that there are people in, who are going to be in heaven who are, the way they view reality and everything is very much in accordance with the Reformation.
Right. I didn't mean to be limiting only to Christians, since that really isn't what I believe.
I thought probably you were, but I wanted to say it.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
So if that's the case, I think where the Bible draws the line is the line of violence and the attempt to use force.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Power over.
You know, Gene, that reminds me, when I was looking at Daniel 11 this morning, because I was reading Tim's latest blog, and it got me into Daniel 11, and I'm like, whoa, I don't remember a lot of this stuff. There is a verse in there that took me directly to what Jesus said, which was a very strange thing, too, where he said something about the kingdom of heaven, the violent take it by violence.
The violent take it by force.
By force.
Yeah. I had to do it.
And in Daniel 11, there's something very similar to that. It says the children of the violent ones try to use something to the analogy, try to establish the, it wasn't the covenant, but something like that, by force. I remember reading that before. And I'm like, that's interesting.
That's a very popular problem passage for exegetes to try to work on. I had to work on that when I was doing my master's degree. And Walter Specht was doing, I think he was teaching a class on exegesis or something, or else he was doing an independent study with me. And he assigned me that passage among another one to do exegesis paper on. I had to wrestle with that.
What'd you come up with?
I don't remember. That was many years ago.
I remember your conclusion.
Who won the match? That's what matters. Who won the wrestling match, right?
I don't know that I won. I don't think I even have those papers anymore. But I think I would have a different answer now than I gave. Mm-hmm. I would need to see the text, though.
I think I'd be like one of the disciples. Jesus, this is a hard saying.
but you're right in that love does not use power over, does not use force, does not use coercion. So if we want to be clear that God is love, then not using power, force, and conclusion, but come let us reason together is incredibly winsome.
Yeah.
He doesn't, he has,
well, that's incredible, the whole, to me, that's the whole,
he does not use it over others.
Yeah. That's what I see in the lamb that was slain.
Mm-hmm.
Is exactly that portrayal of God. Mm-hmm. This is who God is like. Yeah. And the followers, mm-hmm, that followed the lamb don't follow the beast.
Mm-hmm.
They follow the lamb. So there's definitely a huge message in Revelation against force and violence to me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is anybody interested in which four creatures might line up with the four horses?
I was intrigued by that because the last horse is the one that the fourth living creature. I think that's the only place in the text I saw designation for which living creature, you know,
which sort of tips me off that there were probably different creatures for different horses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So I just looked at, you know, the attributes and sort of said, you know, which ones match the best.
Yeah.
So the first one, which would be the white horse and the rider, I think might have been announced by the lion, because it said, if I'm not mistaken, it said, with a voice of thunder, he announced.
Right, right.
And so a lion, you know, it's sort of known for that kind of thing. Okay, right. The second one, which was the red horse, which mm-hmm was about power, mm-hmm, right? Was, I think, this one's a little harder, but I think was the calf or the heifer, because that's about strength. The third one, which is the black horse with the balance and all that stuff, balances and calculating would be the creature like with the face of a man, calculating, naming, all that kind of stuff, buying and selling. Mm. And then the fourth seal, which by elimination would only be one left, would be the flying eagle.
Which is interesting, which was, wasn't that the symbol for Rome? I mean, the United States too. We use eagles. That's our national bird, eagles.
Our eagle that wasn't flying. He's standing on something.
Yes. Thanks, Floyd, for sharing that. That's just interesting to think about that connection.
And now I cannot find that verse in Revelation 11 that I just read this morning.
I thought you said Daniel 11.
Daniel 11, yes. Thank you.
That will help.
Yeah. I am looking at Daniel 11. And I'm looking at all my notes. And for some reason, it's not showing up. But it was fascinating when I read it. I thought, I don't ever remember reading that. Here it is. Verse 14. In those times, there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also, the children of the violent among your people shall lift themselves up to establish the vision, but they shall fall.
Is that, do they fall because they used violence?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just thinking, do we take comfort or do we say, oh, these seals are going to have an application for that last generation. Sorry, I don't know how to get around last generation theology here, but what is the last generation? What happens to them? And is this, you know, are these things all in the past where you go, yay, yippee, I don't have to deal with that? Or is this still something that can sit within the future of whatever a generation that exists at the final end of the prior to second coming?
I think Satan uses the pattern over and over and over. It worked. The same sequence of logic, of manipulation, of social squeezing, conformity is recycled, whether it's in 4 years or 4,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
So you see the repeating pattern. I think that's why it's important to look at the patterns, because then you start, you're looking around and say, wait a minute, I recognize this pattern. I know where this is going.
As it was in the days of Noah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But see, that for me is there is a sense in which, even with the preaching and the warning, there was no hint of catastrophe. Life went on. So what was the deception? And was it, you know, force, fear, intimidation, guilt, and shame? Well, maybe some on Noah, he was the only one, so they mocked him or whatever. I am curious as to the deception that could deceive the elect, if it were possible, and I know we've just touched on that today a little bit, that it seems that it can't be so sharp in relief or so sharp in our view that it's obvious. You know, Sabbath Sunday, it seems like it needs to be more subtle than, I'm not going to deny that it has that possibility, but it seems like it would be far more subtle in terms of coercion leading to violence.
I think that we can't look at deception. It's going to be a progression of thought that we follow to a conclusion we never originally thought we would have.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So I have thought about this in terms of my understanding of the end of sin and sinners is that at the end, the wicked really look at God and say, you know, if you're really like that, I don't want to be a part of you. What if the righteous had to come to the same conclusion? So they see a false picture of God. They see overwhelming evidence that God's that way and say, I guess I was wrong, but if that's the way God is, I'm sorry, I don't want any part of it. So if you're not a loving God, don't include me in your kingdom. That's, I can't think of, the reason I come to that is I cannot think of anything that would be more difficult for me to do. That would be a deception that would be almost impossible for me to overcome. The only way I could survive that is if I was so settled into the truth that I really would not accept any other God except the God of love.
The one we have waited for.
This well, is the one I've waited good. For.
Exactly. If it's not good, it's not God.
Mm-hmm. Which, of course, is why Jesus came to say, this is what God is like. Right. If you know me, you won't be deceived by the counterfeit. Isn't that? And they, you will know him, and that knowing is eternal life. That knowing, that and intimate connection, relationship. Yeah.
I think it's everything. I think it's easier to believe a lie and not have to live up to it than it is to believe the truth. And it has to become an experience, or you don't really know it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
Looking at the great controversy history as revealed in the earth through history, force, fear, intimidation, guilt, shame, it's our experience every day. Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking the seals we have being popped by the Worthy One are a nice reminder of the, I think you said it there, Gene, the progression of thinking that we will be going through. So there's opportunity to counter that thinking and being having it reframed, having it rebooted.
You know, one way to look at this is a really large way, that when Satan invented sin, he created a counter reality. We've been looking at the part, bits and pieces of that reality, and some of them are the bigger blocks and building blocks and what have you of that reality, such as economics and power over and things like that. But he created an alter reality, and he is fighting for that reality. He's continually working and progressing on that reality, because you think about where we have gone in technology in the last 40 years, where we have virtual voices speaking to us, Alexa, Siri, telling us where to go and what to do. And it's so easily to start thinking they're human.
Did you hear the latest announcement?
I had used Siri last Sabbath. If it hadn't been for Siri, I don't know what would happen. I would have been turning around and totally lost.
did you hear the major announcement about Alexa recently?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think I did, but I forget what it was.
This was a huge public announcement, a breakthrough. They have already developed the software, and they're rolling it out to everybody who has Alexa, I guess, that you can, if you can find a recording that's at least, I don't know, only a few seconds, I think, then you can, Alexa will listen to it, and then your children or whoever, you can ask Alexa. Well, the demonstration they gave on stage was, you know, a child says, Alexa, would you read me this book with my grandmother's voice? Their grandmother died. And said, sure, I can do that. And then it starts reading in their grandmother's voice.
Well, that's spooky. Mm-hmm. That's not human now. That's
that opens the door to bridge where you don't even know whether it's Alexa doing it or a spirit doing it anymore.
Exactly.
But that is the latest announcement. I mean, this is what they're pushing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Is that you can now use Alexa to talk to you in your dead relatives or your dead loved ones' voice to comfort you.
Well, I believe that there is when Ellen White said that, you know, Protestantism will reach with one hand to clasp the hand of spiritualism. She was thinking of seances and things like that. And Catholicism is the other one. But she was thinking of seances with spiritualism.
But now we've got
we have a clue how far reaching this is going to be and how terribly deceptive. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I do think there is a melding going on between the demonic and the human.
Yes.
And technology.
Mm-hmm. I mean, a friend of mine says he believes
Satan's taking it over.
It wouldn't surprise us if they develop an app for communicating with the supernatural.
Oh, of course. Why not? We have Ouija boards.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Put it on your phone. I'm sorry.
Just put it on your phone so you don't have to go get a Ouija board.
Right.
Exactly. I was thinking how
I bet money if you went to the app store right now, you could find one.
Yeah. Satan has a counterfeit for everything. And I think he will use we almost worship our phones. Your phone could be a counterfeit God.
Right.
You know.
One of the greatest anxieties identified by the Gen Xers, anyway, is being separated from their phone. There's
Gen Z.
Their anxiety just goes over the top. if they can't have access to.
Yeah, you're getting all your identity, your worth, your value, your purpose for existence out of that screen.
Well, that's true. And, you know, when I have my students do their fast from all technology, they will, some of them will tell me, you know, I slept really well last night and I felt more at peace. I wasn't constantly comparing myself with someone.
Is it up to them how long they go, Gene, or is there a challenge or a goal?
With how long do you ask for the fast?
How long is the fast?
24 hours.
Wow.
Only 24 hours.
Only 24 hours, but they feel.
We did good. Huh. We did good. My son is millennial. He went 3 days off the grid. And he's not married.
There's something we should pay attention to here, and that is, what need is that phone filling? And I believe that it is the need for connection with community, which means that the church is not supplying that.
That's right. That's right.
Look at this group. What are we doing? We're using technology to fill a void in connection with a community of like believers.
It's because it costs too much to fly to the same place every week.
Well, we're illustrating what we're talking about right now.
Yeah.
But we're also illustrating the fact that this technology is it's not the technology that's the problem. It can be used for good.
We're
doing that right now.
Right.
So the thing is not to become Luddites and say, oh, let's get rid of all the technology. The thing is to say, how do we use this to further God's work?
Yes.
Well, I need to go shortly, so sure. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, I think we should start with the fourth seal when we come back, because we didn't fully exhaust this. And then we'll be on to the rest of the chapter. Would somebody like to close with prayer?
I'll close.
Thank you, Nancy.
Lord, I just want to thank you for this time with Bill and Floyd and Mark and Jean and Peggy. It's been so good to connect with them and to hear their ideas. I think this is what you intended for us to come together and say, what do you think this means? How does this fit with a great controversy? How does this fit with other passages in the Old Testament? What does this mean for here and now? So thank you for being a God who reveals, who wants us to be attuned, who wants us to be in the know, most primarily about who you are, how you operate, what your principles are. So we're not caught, and that we can share with others the vital truths of your kingdom that relate to design and bring us light and joy and peace. So opposite of the devil and his schemes, we see just brings bloodshed and hardship, devastation and death. And so for being the God of all comfort, for being the who is the reveal and the God who operates only on the principles of love and truth. Thanks for our time together and bless each one and their pursuit throughout this upcoming week and help us to better know you through your revealed word. Thanks. Amen.
Amen. Mm-hmm.